Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 204 for June 14th, 2009. Coming up in a few minutes.
One of the things I've noticed when going to the bookstore all the time was that while there's a great many books on scotch and a great many books on bourbon, there's very few that cover the full spectrum of the whiskey world.
That's Kate Hopkins, author of the new book, 99 Drams of Whiskey, The Accidental Hedonist's Quest for the Perfect Shot and the History of the Drink. More with Kate in a few minutes. But first, let's look at the news. The 9-year-long legal battle between the Scotch Whiskey Association and Canada's Glenora Distillers is over for now. Canada's Supreme Court has refused to hear the SWA's appeal of a lower court ruling that allows Glenora to keep using the Glen Breton name on its single malt Canadian whiskey. The SWA's complaint is focused on the use of Glen, which it maintains implies that the whiskey comes from Scotland. Glen Breton does have Scottish heritage. It's produced in an area of Nova Scotia settled by Scottish emigrants. And, of course, Nova Scotia can be translated loosely as New Scotland. Glenora sells its whiskey in Canada, a few U.S. states, Europe, and Japan, but the Globe and Mail reports Glenora plans to expand into China and Taiwan now that the legal issues appear to have been cleared up. However, the SWA's David Williamson told the Globe and Mail that the association will try to fight Glenora's applications to register the Glen Breton brand name in countries where it expands if there's a chance that it might confuse consumers. The SWA succeeded last year in getting Chinese officials to recognize the term Scotch whiskey as a collective trademark to fight counterfeiting in China. Now Chivas Brothers has been able to get trademark protection for the labels Chivas and Chivas Regal. Scotch is about 20% of Scotland's annual exports to China, and counterfeiting has been a problem for years. By the way, the Chivas trademarks cover the brand names in both English and Chinese. Changes are coming at the Glenrothes. Longtime blender John Ramsey is retiring and will be succeeded by Gordon Motion, and the newest vintage releases reflect that. The Glenrothes 1988 is one of the final releases for John Ramsey. It's being released in Taiwan and other Asian markets at first, and will be available in other regions as stocks of the 1985 and 1987 vintages sell out. It'll sell for 5,500 Taiwan dollars, or about $170 U.S. at current exchange rates. Gordon's signature is on the 1998 vintage for the first time. It will be the core vintage for the Glenrothes in Taiwan, Singapore, and China, and will sell for 1,500 Taiwan dollars, or about $46 U.S. By the way, I'm hoping to have John Ramsey on a future episode of WhiskeyCast. This is the third straight episode where I've mentioned Isle of Jura, but this time it's not good news. The distillery has been forced to shut down production temporarily after the ferry that serves the island broke down. The Scotsman reports engine problems sent the ferry into dry dock for repairs earlier this month. Last weekend, a replacement ferry was pulled off to serve other contracted routes. The distillery needs the ferry to haul barley and other raw materials to the island and get its spirit and waste products off the island. It only has draft storage to handle a day and a half's worth of waste. Now, back in episode 187 last February, we heard from Fred Lang about the history of Douglas Lang & Company, the blender and independent bottler founded by Fred and Stuart Lang's father, Douglas. The Langs are celebrating the firm's 60th anniversary with a set of special single cask releases starting this month. The first is a 30-year-old Macallan rum finish, and July's release will be a 21-year-old Lafroy aged in a refill cask. There'll be one new release each month through November, and there's a link to the Douglas Lang website for more details. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Lafroig. If you're planning to be at Whiskey Live Glasgow in September, there'll be an entire week of whiskey dinners leading up to the festival on September 12th. The week starts in Edinburgh on the 6th, followed by dinners in Perth, Speyside, Inverness, Oban, and Glasgow on the 11th. Before then, we have the Whiskey Guild's dinner and tasting cruise in Washington, D.C. on June 24th, Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans from July 8th through the 12th, the Classic Malts Cruise along the coast of Scotland from July 11th through the 25th, Another session of the Glenlivet Whiskey School at the Distillery in Speyside from August 3rd through the 5th, and Whiskey Live in Sydney, Australia from August 31st through September 6th. That will also have a series of whiskey dinners leading up to the main event on the 6th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask.
Hi there, my name is John Campbell, Distillery Manager at Laphroaig Distillery. Become a friend of Laphroaig. Claim your own square foot of Islay at laphroaig.com.
I've been a journalist for more years than I'd like to admit, and possibly the highest compliment I can give a book is that it's exactly the kind of book I wish I had written. So you can understand that I'm really envious of Kate Hopkins right now. She's the author of 99 Drams of Whiskey, The Accidental Hedonist's Quest for the Perfect Shot, and The History of the Drink. Kate's book stems from her work creating the Accidental Hedonist blog.
The Accidental Hedonist has been around since 2004. My initial purpose of the blog was just to write posts for notes as I did research on food and things of the like, and it sort of took off and developed an audience and got some popularity. And I was able to use that to parlay that into this book deal. So I don't know if that's what you want, or I can go into further detail if you wish.
Well, let's go into a little more detail for people who might be interested, because there are some Scotch nuts out there who are also foodies to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I try to do with Accidental Hedonist, what it's kind of evolved into, is more of food punditry more than anything else, with an eye towards making sure that we don't forget that food is all about, it is primarily for a fair amount of people about enjoying yourself. Certainly there's the nutritious aspect and the political aspect, but, you know, at times we should just enjoy it for the sake of enjoyment. And I enjoy doing it a great deal. I can't tear myself away from the blog, unfortunately, in some cases. And it's offered up a lot of opportunities for me. I enjoy writing the posts. There's a fair amount of pictures. Sometimes I have guest writers. It's an all-encompassing, my own little minor media empire, one might say.
I know the feeling. Now, you had to tear yourself away from it, though, for a bit to get into Scotch for a while, right?
That is correct, yes.
Tell me how the book came about.
Well, the book came about. What happened was a book agent emailed me probably in early 2006 and asked me if I had any book proposals out there, and I did not. So I set myself up to think about what I wanted to write about, and if book, you know, publishers are asking me for stuff, I should probably supply them something. And one of the topics I discussed, decided upon, was whiskey. One of the things I've noticed from going to the bookstore all the time was that while there's a great many books on Scotch and a great many books on bourbon, there's very few that cover the full spectrum of the whiskey world. We like to regionalize our whiskeys for good reasons, but I thought I could provide a book that would offer a sort of a fuller version, a fuller vision of what the history is.
And you actually tried to cover the entire, essentially, Northern Hemisphere world almost, except for Japan, by covering both the U.S., Scotland, and Canada.
That's correct. In my research and in reading up on this, essentially, I found that whiskey, and this should come as no surprise to anybody, evolved from the Gaelic world. It came from Ireland and Scotland and sort of America by default because of all the Irish and Scottish immigrants in Canada as well. And so I focused primarily on that aspect. That they take up a fair amount of the marketplace as well, that didn't hurt either.
I'll tell you what I liked most about it was interspersing the history with the quest that you and a friend took to go visit distilleries all over the place.
You know, and that was a tremendous amount of fun. I did that intentionally to, you know, there are some places where in history of whiskey, you have to talk about tax code and things like that, because that's pretty much how the British controlled and had their input onto the industry. And it's kind of a dry topic, so I figured the best way to dress it up is to talk about going to the distilleries and drinking a fair amount.
And you ran into a few of my friends while you were on this trip.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, guys like George Grant at Glenfarclas.
Oh, yes. A very nice gentleman. A very, you know, we met him the same day that we met Dennis Malcolm. And the two are sort of 180 degrees from one another. Whereas Dennis Malcolm is very animated and very, you know, just you can sense the passion. George is a very, very calm and very restrained, and seems very proper. And it was a pleasure meeting both of them. It was a good time.
And they both had fun with you and your colleague Krista in some unusual ways at the distillery, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, what George did is he offered up our age in whiskey. Essentially, he asked us both our age and gave us one that represented, you know, Krista had a 30-year-old and I had a 40-year-old a drink. And that was, you know, we were sitting there just contemplating what that means, you know, because as I was growing up, my father was a minor Scotch fan, a minor whiskey fan. But, you know, there was this belief that age was everything, age was everything. So here we were drinking these exquisite drinks and just wondering, wow, this is something special. Dennis took us out to his backyard, one might say, to behind the Glen Grant Distillery, and it was a brilliant morning. You know, a typical Scottish morning with a gray overcast sky, slight drizzle, but a beautiful heather green out. And took us to the safe in the back alongside the creek. And he gave us a drink of 25-year-old Glen Grant out at overlooking the lawn, one might say. It was a beautiful experience.
The other thing I really enjoyed were your tasting notes were some of the most creative I've seen in a long time. Occasionally maybe a bit snarky at times, but really very descriptive in some ways.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to talk especially, you had some interesting things to say about the Brooklady 10.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the intent of this was the intent of the book is to make a newcomer to whiskey sort of an all-hands primer where they can get a high-level appreciation of what they should be looking for and all that. And I figured the best way to do that with whiskey reviews was to find the characteristics that were maybe not using the vernacular that a lot of whiskey professionals use. So, and that was the choice of adding the character aspect of within the whiskey reviews.
I've never heard a whiskey described the way you described this one. Why don't you read the tasting note real quickly?
Oh, it's a morning person, a type of person who is thrilled to be starting the day when the alarm goes off at 5 a.m. Perky and happy, this whiskey is bound to frustrate those of us who are not happy with morning people.
And are you a person who's not happy with morning people? Were you thinking of that when you wrote it?
I am by default a morning person because I have to be with my full-time job. So I respect them, but I'm not fond of it. I guess it's, but I can respect those who do it. You know, if that makes sense. It's sort of my own personal way of waffling, one might say.
And I've never heard a whiskey described as perky before.
I loved how sharp it. I did like how sharp it was, and just how much it played on the tongue. I had not had something like do that to that extent, and it was the only word that I could come up with.
And let's go to the other extremes here, because you write in this book about the search for the perfect shot, or the quest for the perfect shot. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you focused on was the infamous or legendary, we should say, perhaps, Delmore 62-year-old.
Oh, yes. That was the one that Mr. Does Disposable Income purchased for $70,000. And sort of within the book, it's sort of the driving purpose of why we're actually going out and figuring, is there an actual whiskey out there that's worth that amount of money? Well, the answer I found was it was a little bit surprising because I'm a consumer. I have to admit that I'm not much of a collector of anything in my household. But when they start throwing around these numbers, it's based off of a collector's perspective. Now, what I found with Mr. Disposable Income was that he probably took the form of both. He probably filled both worlds. He could afford it, and then could afford to, make the claim amongst his friends and have this legend behind him that he drank a $70,000 bottle of whiskey one day.
But he just didn't drink it. He shared it with the folks at the hotel where he bought it, right?
Mm-hmm. He shared it with the bar manager, I believe, and a couple other folks.
And this was sort of almost a communal experience as well as a hedonistic experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of those things which is sort of a once-in-a-lifetime kind of story, I think, anyways. And it's, you know, it's literally sharing the wealth, one might say, because it was an experience of just this rare bottle of whiskey, and apparently he was celebrating having a really good day on the stock market and wanted to just do something memorable for himself, and he certainly accomplished that.
And you referred to him as Mr. Disposable Income because his name has never been made publicly known.
He has intentionally made sure that that no one's to know who he is. Although I did hear along the way from several people that they know who he is and why he did what he did. So his name is out there. It's just not for public consumption, one might say.
And if someone had shared a $70,000 bottle of scotch with you, you'd have an incentive to keep your mouth shut.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, there may be the chance that he buys another one.
What's next?
Well, right now I'm trying to become a beer judge so that I have the typical, standard, stereotypical American's perspective on beer in that I know I'm aware of Budweiser, I'm aware of Coors, and I'm aware of Miller's, but I also know that there's a larger, much larger world out there. And so I'm hoping to become a beer judge and to discover this world and then also use that as a means to start a new book.
Any more whiskey books in the future?
That's always a possibility. I wouldn't turn it down. What I would like to do is make sure that I offer a different voice in the world. The world's only full. There's enough Charles McLean's and Jim Murray's in the world. I don't need to be another one of those folks. So I would like to make sure I do something a little bit different.
I have to ask one final question. Of the bottles you brought back from your trip, mm-hmm. Which one did you kill off first?
Which one did I kill off first? The Auchincloss I killed off. Some of the other ones just meant too much to me. I still have... the bottle's given to me by John Teeling. I still haven't opened. I have the bourbon, or not the bourbon, but the American whiskey that I got from Buffalo Trace that was aged in a Cabernet cask. I mm-hmm. still have it open. I'm too emotionally attached to them to get rid of them.
I'm sorry to say that most whiskey books never make it out of the food and drink section at many bookstores, but I found Kate's book not only in the new releases section, but very prominently displayed at a couple of my local bookstores. You'll find a link to her Accidental Hedonist blog at the Whiskey Cast website, and her book's available at the Whiskey Cast store, powered by Amazon.com. Just use the store link at the website. That's also where you'll find links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the calendar of events, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I got an email from Aubrey in San Francisco this past week. He and his brother will be attending their first whiskey festival this fall at Whiskey Fest San Francisco, and he wanted to find the episode from earlier this year with tips for making the most of your first whiskey festival. Well, it was in episode 186 from February 8th, 2009. If you have questions about whiskey, I'll try to answer them or find someone who can. Again, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2009, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.